Brian Forrester with us, L.A. Marzulli. Your phone calls doesn't get much better, does it? We'll come back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, Brian Forrester with us, L.A. Marzulli. Brian, let's get back to the flying men of Paracas for a moment. I still find this fascinating. And again, is there any more research on this?
Well, the thing is, again, you have to look at the conventional archaeological studies, and they say, well, these people probably experimented with cactus extract, which was some kind of hallucinogen, and therefore they had visions of people flying around. But we honestly don't know. And that's, again, the sad thing is that these people disappeared off the face of the earth about 2,000 years ago, leaving no direct descendants. So there's no oral tradition, no written language, et cetera. So we have to interpret it. And I honestly, at this point, don't know what the flying men of Paracas represents, but it's definitely worthy of ongoing study.
Well, L.A., with everything you've investigated, the Watcher series, mm-hmm. how would you equate these skulls with all of this?
I would point to a connection with the Nephilim that we hear about not only in Josephus, but the Book of Enoch, found on the Dead Sea Scrolls, Book of Jubilees. I mean, a lot of ancient texts talk about this union of the fallen angelic host taking women and creating this hybrid being known as the Nephilim, which were not human in any way, shape, or form. They were also cannibalistic. They drank the blood of human beings. It states this in the text. I'm not making this up. What's interesting, I want to just add something to what Brian said. When we were in the Museum of Anthropology and Archaeology in Lima, Brian went up to one of the docents that was there and sort of caught the guy off guard and said, well, where do you think these Paracas people came from? And the guy, without hesitation, pointed to the air with his finger. And then, of course, when we asked him again with the camera, he gave us the party line. But off camera and caught, unaware sort of, with his guard down, he pointed to the sky. I found that incredibly intriguing. So, the hypothesis, again, I'm working on is that these skulls and the similar skulls that we see in the Americas are the remnants, the remains of these Nephilim tribes. I'll give you one. I was at a place in, again, the United States, at a historical society, and I was combing over letters and correspondence between these two brothers who were at one particular site and the curator of the museum, along with an archaeologist. And these guys, this is from circa 1912, 1913, and these brothers are going, look, these are not normal skulls. They're elongated. They can't be normal. Don't you guys want to come out and look at them? And the archaeologist is writing, oh, I'm sure you're making a mistake and blah, blah, blah. And it's just probably a disarticulated bone pile. And they're going, no, it's not disarticulated. The skeletons are in situ and it's a airtight, watertight chamber. And we don't know. And they're elongated. All that's vanished. Even the photographs, which I believe they took, have just gone off the record. But we still have their written account. And these skulls were anomalous. But that's just one site, George. There are literally, more than likely, hundreds of sites in the United States. And I'll give you one more thing. Again, this goes back to my friend, Chief Joseph, who's the Native American war chief. And we have been invited to a site, which, again, I don't even know where it is yet. But it's a site in North America where another chief, there are burial mounds there. And he wants us, our team, and of course Brian's included in this, to come up to this area, to go to this area, and do a proper dig. And of course, this would include our resident archaeologist, Aaron Judkins, and do a dig and find out what's in these mounds. The chief believes that they are the bones of the giants. And of course, that would just be astounding.
It sure would.
And a real first to do that. And that is in the works. So we'll see what happens.
All right, let's take some calls. Let's go to Bonnie in Pahrump, Nevada first. Hey, Bonnie, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Thank you. I appreciate your taking my call.
Sure thing.
I'm calling because a couple of weeks ago, I was in Las Vegas meeting somebody, and I pulled up to the valet of one of the casinos, and there was a guy there that was a really nice guy. He was completely bald. He was fairly short. He had the face of kind of like a gray, the upside-down pumpkin type face,
yeah.
But his skull went back at least 5 or 6 inches beyond a normal skull. And I remember looking at him because he was, like I said, completely bald. And it was very distinct, you know, and I wanted to ask him, are you an Anunnaki? You know, but I didn't want to hurt his feelings, yeah. You know, so, but he was definitely, you know, just very distinct. There was no scarring. So it wasn't like he had surgery and his brain, you know, it swelled up or anything, but it was just very, very definitely that he was one of these types of skulls. And really nice guy. He gave me directions to where I was going, but it was just really amazing. I'd never seen anything like that, you know, anywhere. And so I'm going to try to get his picture. I'm going to go back there this week, Friday, and I'll try to get his picture. And if you will put up an email, I'll try to, if it'll let me, you know, I'll try to upload it.
I'd love to see that, Bonnie. Mm-hmm. And Brian, I mean, assuming these are genetic hybrids, I guess it's possible that some of the offspring, some of the blood, some of the DNA is filtering around society today?
Well, that's a great question, because the thing is, when I was in Cusco about 2 years ago, a couple showed up to come on tour with me, and they showed me two photographs that they had just taken from the city of Nazca, where the famous Nazca lines are, and that's 4 hours drive from Paracas. And on the street corner was a man who literally had an elongated head. And I've actually blown the picture up to, you know, to look at his head more in more detail. And it's amazing. Of course, you know, people say, well, go back to Nazca and try to find him. I haven't been able to, but actually my wife and I too, when we were in Egypt in April, we both almost broke our necks when we turned to the right, because there was a man with an incredibly odd-looking skull simply walking down the street. It was we didn't get a chance to take a photo, but I think there are probably, you know, genetic remnants, at least in the Paracas area, and I'm always watching and looking at people to see.
If you get that picture and you want to send it to us, Bonnie, Brian's and Lynn's websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Right now. It's an amazing story. It really is. At what point, Brian, does this thing bust loose, or does it?
Well, of course, you know, scientific protocol, and Lloyd Pye was very much part of that. He and I, sure, you know, were in constant contact for 2 years because he was fascinated with the elongated skulls of Peru. You have to replicate the testing. And so, as Elias said, these results are initial, but the geneticist, who's a very, very, you know, professional person, was in shock. And so we're going to replicate from the samples that he already has and maybe be able to get more samples to him to, you know, do some more rigorous testing and make sure that these results are scientifically sound.
Okay, next up we go to Sid in Abilene, Texas, on the wild card line. Sid, good morning.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us.
Take my call. Thank you.
Sure thing.
I remember reading in Genesis where it talks about those angels that were in heaven, and they were watching the daughters of men, and they come down to have relations with them, and their children were offsprings. They were giants, and they were mean. They could hold a man at arm's length. And you said something about they. You say the picture of it. Look like a giant was flying.
Yeah.
Maybe that represents wings represent where they came from. I mean their heritage, you know, their parents, the angels themselves.
Well, these are definitely the possible biblical references, L.A.
Yeah, they certainly are, and that's why I found the flying men of Paracas very intriguing. There's a clip that we show in Watcher 7, George. In fact, I hope to meet you this weekend because Richard and I are driving to Arizona. We entered Watcher 7 in the UFO Film Festival.
Good, I will see you there.
Yeah, so that's going to be fun. But there's a clip that we actually sat down with Jaime Masson and showed him. I said, Jaime, have you ever heard of the flying men of Paracas? And, you know, Jaime kind of looked at me and said, no. And I showed him a picture of the flying men of Paracas from this ancient textile, at least a couple of thousand years old. And then what Richard has done, Richard Shaw, our director and producer, he has juxtaposed that flying men of Paracas with the flying humanoids seen over Mexico. And of course, look, we don't know. We weren't back in Paracas 2,000 years ago, but we do find it intriguing because here it is, 2014, and we can go back a few years, and there are videos of flying humanoids over Mexico. So, is there a correlation? In all honesty, George, we don't know, but we find it absolutely intriguing.
Sure is. John is in Castor Valley, California, west of the Rockies. Hey, John, go ahead.
Hey, good evening there, George. Nice to talk to you again.
Howdy.
I wanted to make a comment about the elongated skulls, and this is in regards to my own experience that I had and how they looked, how their facial features appeared. Because I had an experience that I came on the show with that I talked about, which I had a device show up, right, wake me up at like 4 o'clock in the morning directly in front of my face, followed me around several times. But in direct relation to that, I was I received a mental image of this woman, and who had elongated skull. But she had a deep, deep bronze skin, and I could not fully see her face. But what I could see was that her mouth was much broader than ours, and that her facial features had a sort of a texture to her that were not like her skin. But she was completely bald.
Hmm.
And I've done some research since then, and what I've also found reference to the Nephilim, but also the possibility that these same people were considered the serpent priests of old because of their features.
Were they also, Lynn, were they possibly cannibals?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's what we read in the Book of Enoch, ancient, you know, non-biblical text, but certainly quoted about 70 times in the Tanakh and referenced in Jude's little book. So we can certainly appreciate its historicity. And what's interesting, it talks about the Nephilim becoming cannibals, drinking the blood of human beings. I mean, it states that in the text. And look, it's a jump to say that all Nephilim were like that, but it seems like that they were. Again, we get from the Native American oral tradition in the United States, we hear this over and over and over again, the idea of cannibalism. Now, we can't make that jump to Paracas because we don't know. There doesn't seem to be any evidence of that so far that we've seen in Paracas. But again, as Brian erudately pointed out, there just has not been that much study of this ancient culture, which just appears out of nowhere about 3,000 years ago, perhaps a little longer than that, and settles in this beautiful bay known as Paracas. It's just, you know, academia has not done due diligence in studying it, and so that's one of the reasons why we're down there. And constantly, I'll go down again in May with a tour group. Of course, Brian will lead that group, but we'll be lecturing every night talking about a lot of what we're talking about here, but in greater depth, because we'll have hours and hours and hours to educate the people. It's going to be fun, but that's why we're studying it. That's why we're sort of on the trail.
We're off to Mississippi now. John's with us. John, go ahead.
Hey, George, I had a question. Talk about the skulls, and they want to know what the people look like. Have you ever thought of going to a forensic pathologist? I'm not sure if I'm using the correct title, but how when they put the clay on an unidentified skull to try to see what the person looked like so the public can identify it. Have they ever thought of trying to do that?
L.A., do you want that one?
Yeah, I think Brian will weigh on it, too. We've had several people. Mark LaPlume, for instance, has drawn what these skulls may have looked like with flesh on them. Another digital artist has taken it to task also and done some wonderful modeling. You know, the problem is it's all conjecture. Again, I've taken the model of the skull that Joe Taylor did and shown that to a forensic anthropologist, and he was really taken aback by what he was seeing. But it's, you know, I think the more people that we can get to take a look at this and to maybe extrapolate what these things might have looked at, get three or four different viewpoints, and then let people sort of make up their own minds. In all honesty, it's all conjecture. We really don't know what they look like.
Worldwide, are these skulls found all over the place or just South America?
They actually were a global phenomenon, and that's what David Childress and I wrote about in our book about cranial deformation. They were in the area of the Middle East, like in Iraq, Georgia, as in the country of Georgia, in Europe, in Germany. One recently was found in England. They were, the Olmec seemed to have looked that way. People in not Polynesian, but actually Melanesia. And so what I've been trying to do is try to look at global migration routes, studying the winds and currents, because I'm a sailor. So trying to figure out where the original people would have come from, you know, where they would have traveled, why they would have traveled. And the thing is that even Easter Island, intriguing Easter Island, which I've been to twice, quite recently, there are stories, including Van Roggeveen, who was the first European to land there. He gave the name Easter Island to it. He said when he was there that he observed people who were tall, short, light-skinned, dark-skinned, blonde-haired, black-haired, and red-haired. And there is a tradition on Easter Island that the oldest of the people, the first civilization, had elongated skulls.
It's an amazing story. It truly is. And L.A., back to the DNA for just a moment. What next needs to be done?
Well, we need to get other samples, obviously, and we need, really, to do a whole sequence, a whole genome. That's a lot of money. And of course, the late Lloyd Pye was trying to get that with the Starchild skull. It's about, we've been quoted, Brian and I, about $300,000 to really work up a whole genome. However, we've got a very small war chest. We are in the process of doing carbon-14 dating, and we should have results fairly soon with that. That'll be very interesting to see what that comes in at, you know, how far back it goes. But obviously, the DNA sampling has to continue, and that's what we're working on. It's just going to be amazing if the preliminary evidence is any indication of where this is going to go, it's really astounding. It's sort of groundbreaking. And in my opinion, it sort of blows the whole evolutionary tree.
Oh my
like
God.
Even as the geneticist said, quoting, I am not sure the sample that he took, will even fit into the known evolutionary tree. So, I mean, it sort of blows the whole Darwinian thing out of the water and looks to some outside agency experimenting or manipulating the human genome.
Are there other civilizations, Brian, that talk about these elongated skulled people?
Definitely. Again, it was a global phenomenon, especially about 2,000 years ago, where it was always the royal family or the elite class that had these elongated skulls. The thing is that in a place like Paracas, because it's desert and it's so dry, there's less than an inch of rain a year. The sand has salt in it, so it's the perfect place to preserve. Whereas in Olmec territory, which is in Mexico, you know, it's much more of a jungly kind of environment, and human remains break down very rapidly. So I think, you know, if we look into where the tradition is in desert areas such as Iraq or other parts of the Middle East, hopefully we'll be able to get more, more evidence.
Super. Well, we're going to come back and take final calls with both of you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, the New World Order, are they out to get us to eradicate the population? Tune in on that program, and when we come back with Brian Forrester and L.A. Marzulli, we'll take final phone calls as we talk about these elongated skulls. Welcome back, Brian Forrester, L.A. Marzulli. Brian, if the cradle of civilization was in the modern-day Iraq, how did these beings, these hybrids, how did they get to South America? I mean, how did this migration occur?
Well, the thing is, right now it's just a theory. We're trying to figure out where the Paracas would have originated from, and I'm kind of guessing the Middle East because of its great antiquity, high civilizations being there. But at this point, it's honestly speculation.
In LA, the cranial area of the skull, would that have given them much bigger brains than what the modern humans have?
Well, what's interesting about that, George, and again, I'm speculating here, it's total conjecture, and I understand that. But what if that a greater cranial capacity not only gave them greater intelligence, but perhaps what we would call supernatural powers? What if they were able to, like, read minds? What's interesting about this, and again, it goes back into Native American oral tradition. I interviewed a Native American who talked about that these giants, who dwelt in the hill country. When they would go, when the Native American people, his tribe would go out and hunt elk, there were giants there. They would bring offerings to the giants. And he talked about the oral tradition, and I asked him specifically, where did this come from? Where did you hear it? He said he first heard it from his grandfather. So it's been passed down orally from generation to generation. And the punchline is simply this, that these giants who are in the Americas, where this man's tribe was, could read your mind. Now, that's their oral tradition. I'm not making this up. I can't prove that, but I do respect the oral tradition. Why would these people state something like that? And, of course, the problem with this is many anthropologists just discount it. Oh, it's superstition. Oh, it's just nonsense. But what if there is a supernatural dynamic to this whole thing? And I, quite frankly, that's where I'm leaning towards. I can't prove that. But when I hear more and more stories like this coming from Native Americans in this country who have heard it from their grandfathers and back it goes, I am really intrigued.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, it's an amazing story. And again, you both are tipping more toward these are hybrids. Again, conjecture that these are more hybrids than just straight ETs who came down to the planet.
Yeah, for me, this is the hypothesis I'm working under is that these are the remnants of the Nephilim tribes, which fled the Levant, the Promised Land, about 3,500 years ago and spread out. Many of them came into North America. Others sailed across the Atlantic and wound up in South America. And from their making landfall, you know, probably went up to Paracas. But that's, again, that's conjecture. But that's the theory.
Would these entities, would they have been around during the flood of Noah?
Well, this is where it gets interesting from my perspective. I believe that the flood of Noah is thousands of years ago. And it wiped out the Nephilim that were here on the planet. But then there's a second or third and fourth incursion. And what we see is that, again, this outside agency, which I believe are the fallen angelic host, and I need to state that when I say fallen angelic host, you know, people get this idea of angels, which is, you know, hi, little guys with wings. These are incredibly powerful, super intelligent entities. We really don't know what they're capable of. We get hints of that. So that being said, this angelic host was doing this, apparently, over and over and over and over again. And that's, I've written about this extensively. I continue to write about it. And what it ties into, of course, is genetic experimentation happening with the breeding program, which we read about in the whole UFO phenomena. In my mind, George, is a definite connection between the two. And I think it's the same outside source. The fallen angelic hosts, they're interdimensional beings coming here, messing with the genome, creating some sort of hybrid being. Heck, Dr. Jacobs talks about that. We've interviewed him numerous times.
Yep.
You know, so I think that's what's going on.
Okay, let's take some final calls here for both of you. We'll go to first-time caller Jim in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Jim, go ahead.
Hi. What do you think happened to them, and how did the human race start to dominate? Are they still among us, kind of controlling us, or how did they really disappear and we became the dominant species?
Well, let me take that, and I'm sure Brian will want to maybe throw something in there too, but let's just first look at the Native American lore. Over and over and over again through different tribes, they talk about fighting and eliminating the giants or the red-haired, tall cannibals. That's what the oral tradition in Native American culture talks about this. So there's something that's going on. Brian said earlier that the Paracas people maybe were, you know, taken or just they just sort of disappear. Was that because of the Nazca people warring against them? When I hear that, it echoes what I hear from Native Americans in this country, that other tribes move into the area, see these giant cannibalistic entities, hybrid beings, whatever, and there's some sort of war that takes place. And look, if we all heard it from one source, it would be questionable, but it's multiple sources in the Americas, in North America, that we hear this from. So there's something going on, and it's repeated over and over and over again. And what I mean by that is it seems like there are many different incursions of this outside agency, which I will call the fallen angelic host, messing with the human genome and producing this hybrid offspring known as the Nephilim.
Kirk in Modesto, California, your turn on Coast to Coast.
Thank you. I had a couple questions. Sure, Brian, have you considered checking in with the Sasquatch DNA that they're working on to see if there's anything comparable there? And then my more important question, have you been stonewalled by the local government and getting your permits and getting this testing even done?
Well, yeah, the thing is that, conventional archaeology, both in Peru and from international scholars, is that this is all cradle boarding. They don't really address where the Paracas came from. They do have theories which I think are not logical, because there was actually a German DNA study done about 4 years ago where they compared ancient DNA from the highlands of Peru, where supposedly the first high civilization rose, and that was compared to the Paracas and early Nazca people, and there was very little genetic connection. So that kind of blows the theory that a high civilization from the highlands of Peru, pre-Inca, came down to the coast and then became the Paracas. It's simply a mystery, but since they lived right on the ocean, Totora reed, which is a great boat-building material, has been there for thousands of years. I think these people were also great seafarers, because there's even evidence in the archaeological record of sea lion remains and whale remains. They may have been sea lion hunters and whale hunters. And if you have that capability to travel out to sea and chase large animals, you probably have the capability of not global travel, but major movement by ship, either to Paracas or back and forth from Paracas to other parts of the Pacific.
Okay, good. Thanks for that. In the time remaining, L.A. and Brian, kind of, and this for you, L.A. specifically, kind of paint a picture of what this planet looked like with these beings on it when they were here.
Well, thank you for that. That's a great question, George. And Watchers 6, we sort of covered this thing, and it ties into what Brian and I have been talking about all night with the megalithic structures that are all over the planet. In On the Trail with the Nephilim, there's a site called America Stonehenge. And that site, when you go from the center of the henge out to the summer standing stone, summer solstice standing stone, and you draw a line from the center of the henge to the summer solstice standing stone and continue that line, you'll wind up in Stonehenge, England, splitting the center trilithon. That's not by accident. But it gets better. When you extend the line, you wind up in Beirut, Lebanon. We have extended the line further, and now it has come into a place where I call Nephilim Central. That line intersects 47.5 miles between Baalbek in Lebanon and Gilgal Raphaim, which is the home of the Nephilim in northern Israel today. Exactly 47.5 miles between the two. So I think that there were megalithic structures all over the planet. There was some sort of a grid system. I'm not the first person to come up with this. Other people have posited the same theory, same idea. This grid was destroyed in some sort of cataclysmic way. And what's interesting about this, in my particular worldview and theory, this ties in with ancient prophetic texts that warn us it'll be like the days of Noah. And if the grid system was there at that time, which I believe it was, and perhaps that grid system may have been used to enslave humanity. What's interesting, and I realize this is dark stuff, and I'm painting a dark picture here. What's interesting, we're told, and again, prophetic texts, that in the latter days, in the last days, that there'll be some sort of a one-world government, one-world religious system, won't be able to buy, sell, or trade without this mark. And that system is now in place with the World Wide Web that we have. We're tracked everywhere. Look at NSA. Everything is computer generated. They can track all of our transactions. So I think there's a correlation between the two. I think the ancient world may have been extremely dark. Mm-hmm. What we're into today, when we look at what we talked about this a little bit earlier, what the Nazis did, the backbreeding and Nephilim, I think we're in some very strange times. I think we're entering into that.
What are the possibilities of whoever genetically altered these creatures that they would come back? Brian?
Really, that's not a question I can properly answer. Probably L.A. is better.
All right, L.A.?
Well, again, George, we seem to have established some sort of a link between what happened in antiquity, and I'm pointing again to the Raman spectroscopy hair sample, which is on your site that Webmaster Lex put up for us, and it's there. And you know, look, it's not completely conclusive. I get that, but it's incredibly intriguing when you look at the slope from the hair, from the red hair from Paracas, and you look at the slope on the graph from the hair from an alien hybrid being. And they track almost identically. Now, that's, you know, you can say what you want, but that's hard scientific evidence that seems to point and create and establish a link between what happened thousands of years ago and what is happening today. And again, it goes back into the hypothesis that there's an outside agency manipulating the genome. And in my hypothesis and worldview, it is the fallen angelic host, interdimensional beings messing with us.
Back to some more final calls. We go to Whitefish, Montana. First-time caller, it's Bill Stern. Bill, you're on with Brian and Lynn Marzulli.
Hello.
Hey, Bill.
Hey, am I on?
Yes, you are.
You're on, Bill.
Hey, well, listen, nice show, great thing. Just tell you guys, if I could win the lottery, I'll fund you.
Thanks. Thank you.
That would work.
I got a question for you. I've been listening to this, and maybe I missed something, but it's like you're not, you haven't talked about the skeletons of these guys, or did I miss something?
Yeah, you missed that. We did talk about it, but let's talk a little bit more about it as well. 300-some skulls, not a lot of skeletons there, Brian, but what about whatever they did find? What did we have there?
Well, the thing is, in the late 1920s, the archaeologist Julio Teo did an excavation. He found 300 mummy bundles. So those are the complete skeletons wrapped in very heavy textiles or multi-layered textiles. Most of them have been in the museum in storage since that time, and there's been basically zero access to them. What I've seen in the field is, basically when we've been able to see a hand or a foot, they do have five fingers and five toes. So we're not looking at, you know, the six finger, six toe phenomenon, but they were quite tall. What it's going to take is it will take more time to be able to have a facility and the rights and permission from the Peruvian government and with their archaeologists to be able to thoroughly examine a number of these skeletons and have doctors and forensic anthropologists there to be able to see if there are physical differences between humans living at that time and the Paracas. So at this point, unfortunately, due to lack of resources, we just don't know. But it's an ongoing process.
What a great story, though. Just fantastic. Ted, Idaho Falls, Idaho. Thanks for holding so long, Ted.
Okay, great. Well, I've got a quick tip for you. I know you're running out of time, but given your time frames of about 2 or 3,000 B.C., and then the people disappeared and they came from the Middle East, Professor Hugh Nibley wrote about this many years ago. He was an expert on Middle Eastern civilization, and he wrote about this group that came from the Middle East, from Iraq, and they traveled by sea to the Americas, and then they eventually destroyed themselves through civil war about 2,000 years ago. And he refers to them as the Jaredites. Have you ever heard of that?
Can you tell me the author's name? I'd like to look that up. Quibley, is that who it was?
Okay, it's spelled Jaredites.
Okay.
And one of the books that Professor Nibley wrote, a number of books, but this one was called Lehi in the Desert and the World of the Jaredites.
Interesting.
I have not heard of that, L.A.
Okay, well, I got a...
Well, let's see where you are. There you go, Ted.
I ordered them on the Internet. But it's a fascinating book, and they're not a well-known, not much is known about them. But he pulled together what information he had. Like I say, he was an expert on Middle Eastern civilization.
Interesting. Fascinating.
And his last name is spelled Nibley, N-I-B-L-E-Y.
All right. We'll check into that. Thank you so much. Brian, for you next, and then you, Lynn, what's next?
Well, I'm going to, you know, of course, continue my ongoing work here, but also I'm very fortunate to be going to Egypt on March 30th with your friend Stephen Mailer.
Oh, super!
And we're going to be exploring the lost ancient, or you know, the obvious evidence of lost ancient technology in Egypt. We have a tour going on, and it'll be my second trip to Egypt. And for those who haven't been and haven't had the ability, those who have even been and haven't had the ability to look at some of the foundations of some of the ancient buildings there, you can see clear signs that there was a major civilization before the dynastic Egyptians.
Mm-hmm. And how about you, L.A.?
Well, I'm actually compiling On the Trail of the Nephilim, Volume 2, with some incredible evidence, George. I can't wait to really announce it. Some of this will tie into our recent trip from Peru, of course, with Brian and what we looked at there. But there's a lot of stuff in the Americas which has not been talked about, and I can't wait to really start revealing some of that. And we've got hardcore physical photographic evidence, which you know, will be showing up in the next several months.
Well, thanks to both of you. Riveting. I mean, we could have gone on another four more hours with this. Incredible. And again, get up to the coasttocoastam.com website. Take a look at the elongated skulls. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lux Lonehood, Sean Laudasaur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, George Knapp, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.